Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the second act. For the 1,627th time, 34 years worth of TechNets. And for those who want to see the past TechNets, you've got to visit the website of amateurradio.tangovictor. And there, the last 10 years worth of TechNets are recorded. And so the one that we're starting tonight, a few days downrange, like probably Wednesday or so, this one will also be on that website. The supporting website is also at K1MJM, mic number 2, at liveartechnet.com, and there you'll find other pieces of material that support the TechNet, pictures, graphs, and so on, and technical articles. The main purpose of the TechNet, as you guys have heard so far, so many times before, is to have a gathering of amateur radio operators in which they share each other's information about the magic of radio, how all this stuff works, and how to make it work better. The first hour or so, we take check-ins of people who do have a question or a comment. Need not sign in because you're listening. After 34 years, we believe somebody is listening. That's already been proven. Okay, at this time, we'll take check-ins. Please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in might sound like this, into FDJ, hip and deck, and yes. So give me your call letters, name, and the word yes right now. K2LIW, listening.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
K-C-2-S-H-O, John, yes.
Okay, we've got Joe and John. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Once again, just like those guys did, just right. Call letters, name, and the word yes. K2RIW listening.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. The name here is Joe, and yes.
Okay, thank you for Joe number 2. And one last call. Anyone with a question or a comment? Call letters, name, and the word yes. Right now, K2RIW listening.
This is N2KW, Alan, now.
Okay, Alan with a no. And one last call. Anyone else with a check-in for the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Call letters, name, and the word yes. Okay, Joe, you're number 1 on the runway, and how are things going on the South Shore? To be 2LYY, Joe number 1, K2LIW listening. You got it, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. How you doing? To be 2LYY. This question is fairly simple, so you should be able to dispense with it fairly quickly. A remote I have has some instructions in the remote that for testing it, this is an IR remote used for electronic appliance, that you can hold it near, very close to an AM radio between stations, press the remote buttons, any of them, and hear a pulsing sound in the radio, which actually you do. I can't see what it produces on a service monitor, but I can hear it on a radio. And I know these remotes can be seen on many types of cameras. I have a camera that you can't see it. And when you press the button and look in the camera, you see like a bluish type of light on the front of it, which normally you can't see because it's IR. But what phenomena is happening and why can you hear this on an AM radio between stations? Back to you.
Yeah, Radio Shack also makes a card that when you sensitize it by shining it near light and then go into a dark room, aim your remote at it, it lights up and you can see it flashing. The digital code that comes out of a remote when you're pressing it, pressing one of its keys, might be, for instance, so to speak, but it's being sent very fast, repetitively. And so that on-off current to the light-emitting diode is what you're hearing in your AM radio. It's got a very fast rise time and very fast short fall time of the voltage slash current going to that light-emitting diode. So an intermittent voltage. I mean, if you took a 1.5-volt battery with a piece of wire between the bottom of it and the top of it, and held it near an AM radio and scratched that wire, you would again hear noise in your AM radio in between stations. So any interrupted voltage or current is making an extremely broadband signal. That broadband signal probably goes out to at least 1 megacycle before it starts falling off at 60 dB per octave, depending on the rise time and the fall time. So you're just listening at an impulse noise picked up by your AM radio. I'll pass it back to you, Joe. Drag your feet in case other people have a better explanation than the one I just gave. W2RYY with some delay. T2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, I guess that pretty much answers that. That's going to be an old record. A question was answered in less than 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's a record for you and me as a combination. We normally get deeper than that. But interrupted currents at a very close range to an AM radio is an extremely sensitive thing. It's looking for fractions of a microvolt of signal. And with a few inches of spacing between that remote and your radio, you provide more than enough signal for it to respond. And you can tune it to the low end of the band, the high end of the band, as long as you're in between stations, you'll get almost the same response. I think you'd get a slightly stronger response down at the low end than up at the high end. Go right ahead, John.
Yeah, that's interesting, Dick. It's KC2WGB. I'm sure you've noticed it. Years ago when I was playing with my flash attachments for cameras, the old flash bulbs, the AM radios would be disrupted by that flashbulb also. So it's fun investigating those things, just like noisy switches and things like that. Good stuff.
Comment.
Okay, comment, who is that? Give us your call letters and name.
Yeah, KC2SHO. I used to know when my brother was driving his hot rod car home with his MSD multiple spark ignition and non-resistor wires. I could hear him coming from miles away on my AM radio. KC2SHO.
John, did he have an AM radio in his automobile, and did it work under those conditions?
Yeah, I don't think he would have used that part of the dial, but I'm sure, you know, the radios that he would have had installed at that time would have had that capability, but I would doubt that he was tuning there.
In the case of a remote, the current being turned on and off to that diode is, I'm going to pick a number, 20 milliamps, but it's very close. You've only got inches of spacing between it and your AM radio. In the case of the xenon flash tube, it's in a photographic flash. During that microsecond of discharge, a very large number of amperes flowed. Therefore, my guess is, John, that you could hear a click in your AM radio at a much larger distance with a photographic flash. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yeah, those gas-fired ones were really noisy, but Also, just the old flash bulbs, the bayonet flash bulbs, they did the same thing. Not quite as severe, but yeah, the xenon was very, very prominent.
In the case of a AM radio tuned between stations, and maybe not even tuned between stations, and you discharge a photo flash tube, you're only getting one discharge, so it's one very loud click. Would you even hear that if the AM radio was tuned to a station, John? KC2WGB? Describe what the sound out of the loudspeaker sounds like, K2RAW. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Well, what I was doing is in the photo lab, I would have my radio on listening to a station, and that's how I noticed it. And the xenon, there was two clicks. One was very strong, and the next one was like a repetitive pulse after it, but it was quite, I would say, at least 10 dB less.
Yeah, question number one, John, is were you tuned to a station at the time? It sounds like you were, and you had a very loud click when you flashed the tube, and after that, the very next thing the xenon flash circuit is doing is it's running an inverter to recharge that capacitor. So the beginning of the charging of that capacitor is that series of clicks that I think you heard afterwards. That sounds about right, John? Over to you, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, I think you have it exactly right, Dick. Yes, it was on a station. I was listening to some music while I was doing that, and I was amazed at that. With the amount of capture, you would think, although it's AM, you would think that that station, with the tremendous signal that's being amplified, wouldn't even hear that flash. But no matter where I did it in the photo lab, and that was about a 400 square feet area, no matter how far I got away from it, it would still do it.
And John, I'm sure you heard it significantly when you tuned to an AM station. Did you even hear it when you were tuned to an FM station? Over to you, John.
Yes, I tried to test that, and yes, if I got very close to the FM radio, which I don't think now that was RF, I think that was being coupled directly into the audio line.
There's a slim possibility it was still coming through the RF circuitry of the FM radio, but impulse noise, lightning, and things like that, falls off at 6 dB per octave. So although it's getting a lot weaker when you get up to 88 megacycles, 88 to 108, there's a slim chance that you can still hear it if there was a close enough spacing between the flash tube and the radio. But AM-wise, my guess is you could hear that from a xenon flash tube. You could probably hear that almost half a block away if you were tuned in between stations and tuned to the station with the flash tube in the same room with you. My guess is that that click out of your AM radio was probably 10 dB above the noise of the station you were listening to. Is that about right, John? K2RIW.
Yes, it was. That's how I noticed it. You know, minor clicks that I would hear, you know, you wouldn't even pick that up as you're working, but it was enough to disrupt the presence of that audio where you definitely heard it. But, you know, that's a... I wonder if I would have used an automobile and checked that distance out and checked that stroke. I wonder what distance it would couple in. That's an interesting point.
John, I'm sure you have a spectrum analyzer. That would be interesting to look at that on a spectrum analyzer with trace hold to see how it displays out in the broadcast band looking up.
There again, that's something I didn't think of. Maybe Dick has some words on that.
Yeah, catching it on a spectrum analyzer is going to give you a probability of intercept problem. The way a spectrum analyzer works is it has a narrowband IF superheterodyne receiver that is scanning across the band. And you might have it setting for scanning 30 sweeps per second. Each sweep is 33 milliseconds, so to speak, and you might be scanning some 1 to 10 megacycles or something like that. So you've got a narrowband IF scanning across the frequency region, and you're listening to a discontinuous signal. The actual discharge of the xenon flash tube and the noise it's making probably only lasts for 1 microsecond. So if your receiver, your spectrum analyzer is tuning across the band, and if it's tuning across the low end of the band at the instant the flash goes off, you'll get a spike at the low end of the band and nothing else. And if it was tuning across the high end of the band, you get a spike at the high end of the band and nothing else. So in order to really look at the total spectrum, you'd have to make a whole lot of flashes. And with the random timing between the sweeping of the spectrum analyzer versus the flash of your xenon flash tube, you'll eventually fill up the screen, but it would take a lot of flashes to do that. So because it's a discontinuous signal, non-repetitive in the time domain, you're not going to see very much on the screen during any one flash. The slight exception to that is the recharging of the capacitor of that inverter will give you a much weaker signal that will give you a little bit more spread on the screen. You see what I'm saying on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. KC2WGB. It would also be interesting to put it in the strobe mode, which is pretty quick. I think that would probably be equivalent to a bin-up function for the spectrum analyzer.
Comment?
Yeah, if you're running the spectrum analyzer in the peak hold mode while you're strobing the photo flash, now you fill up that screen a lot faster. Sounds like Mr. SHO has some further comment. Go ahead, John.
I didn't check in again. That might have been somebody else. KC2SHO.
Okay, who is this said comment?
Yeah, this is a WA2, Victor David Henry. Just a comment on the spectrum analyzer. These real-time spectrum analyzers that Tektronix has out now, they give you a real instantaneous time. In other words, they can look at a whole chunk of bandwidth, even though there are fleeting signals. I had an opportunity to play with one of them, looking at some of these Bluetooth signals that are really very fleeting. Go ahead.
Very fine, John, number two. And any discontinuous current or voltage is making a very large spectrum. That is to say, it covers a very large frequency region, and the signal itself across that region only lasts for approximately the duration of the peak rise or the peak fall of the current going to that wire that's nearby. And so that short little wire and the wiring of your circuit that we're describing, that constitutes an antenna. So it's a beautiful example of the fact that at times, something extremely small. I mean, that piece of wire in your remote going to the light-emitting diode, the infrared light-emitting diode at the front end of your remote control circuit, it's a couple of inches long, and your AM radio is running at roughly 1 megahertz. 1 megahertz, the wavelength is 300 meters. A couple of inches of antenna is way too short. Thousands or 100,000 times too short to be a real antenna, but yet the sensitivity of that radio can easily pick that up. Kind of magic the way radio works.
Dick, also Windhurst generators, I'm sure you know, will drive your AM radio crazy.
Yes, it would. The discharge of your Windhurst machine. And I've done that. Operate an AM radio near a WIMP source machine, and even when you've got the two probes set at a large distance, you only get a discharge once every 5 seconds. The individual tinfoil strips that are on the round wheels that are rotating, as those individual foil strips make contact with the brushes, I say contact, come near the brushes and there's an arcing that takes place. Every one of those passes of the tinfoil will make a piece of radio noise. So you'll hear a buzzing radio noise even before the discharge occurs. So give that a try, John. You'll get a kick out of that. I'm trying to remember why I was running that experiment with a radio. It was a particular phenomenon I was looking for at the time. It'll come back to me a little bit later. Next person on the list was John, KC2SHO. What would you like to talk about tonight, John? KQRIW?
And K2RIW, KC2SHO, good evening to you, everyone else on the net. First I was going to talk about something different, but with the AM discussion, it reminded me of something that I saw at the Motorola Museum. And that was on some cars in the early days of low-band radio reception. They were stringing a V-shaped wire underneath of the car, and I found this to be completely outside my realm of belief, not being from that era. How well did that work? What about coupling to the ground? What about being underneath of that metal chassis and all that steel? How well did those antennas work? Or was this a stopgap measure just to get something on the car? K2RW, do you understand what it is I'm talking about? I could explain further. KC2SHO.
In the early days of AM radios on automobiles, I'm talking about the early days of radio from my point of view when I was just first studying the subject, 1950, 1960. Most of the AM radios, the antenna was a whip antenna on the fender of the car. And that whip antenna was an E-field probe and a fancy circuit with a 90-ohm or 120-ohm piece of coax cable. The coax cable was a skinny little piece of wire with a lot of air gap inside of a piece of plastic tubing with shielding on the outside of it. That was the transmission line, very high impedance transmission line. And that AM radio was an extremely high impedance antenna. It was a very high impedance antenna. You touch that antenna with your finger and the reception would disappear. So what I think you're saying, John, is that for a period of time, there was a manufacturer of automobiles that strung a piece of wire under the chassis of the car as an AM radio antenna. Give us a little bit of a description as to how that was suspended. What car did that? Roughly what year are you talking about? Over to you, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RW, KC2SHO. Well, from what I saw, and maybe I could find something further online, starting up about maybe where the engine and the transmission would be mated, there was a common point and a wire then stretching from that point, this is the center of the car, by the way, a wire stretching from that point back to the rear fender area just before the wheel. So almost think of a flying V, a delta shape underneath of the car. I'm not sure if this was for covert police operations. I may have the photo I took with the explanation of that, as I can't recall what the explanation was, but I do remember it specifically saying this was early, you know, low-band antenna solution. And I guess it was, insulated from the car somehow. Without looking further, that's probably about all I have right now. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
W2OSO with a comment.
OSO, we'll get you in a second. Mr. SHO, what year car, what brand of car, when did you see this, and were you doing service on the car? Is that how you noticed that one? KC2SHO, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KQIW, KC2SHO. This was in the Motorola. Well, it wasn't their museum. Motorola, when you visit their facility, they have different buildings have different pieces of history in them. The building I was in for training had some interesting items in it. And in this building was a car, probably from the 30s, maybe 40s, with this antenna strung underneath of it and a photo explaining the antenna. I should go back to my photos and find that, because I'm sure I photographed also the explanation. But it was underneath the car. I found that to be completely fascinating.
When you were at that Motorola site, were you in Schaumburg, Illinois at the time? John, go ahead.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's one of their headquarters, and I can't think of the name of the town of the other one. So Motorola was doing that work. Okay, the other person with a comment, give us your full call letters, your name, and your comment. Go right ahead. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, good evening, Dick. It's Bob, W2OSR. May have said my call too quick. Anyway, but I remember having seen old cars of the era of around the 1930s. A number of them had loop antennas mounted underneath the running board. If you're quite a bit younger than I am, you don't even know what a running board is. Much less that there were antennas under them. Some of the old radios, back in that era, before we had some of the new modern electronics, they were tubed. The power supplies were actually switch mode power supplies, but they used a device called the vibrator. But back to the antenna, I believe it was a magnetic loop antenna mounted in a horizontal plane underneath the running board, as near as I can remember, because that's a long time ago. Back to you.
Yeah, the running board was a kind of a lip that stuck out from the bottom of the door out into the air. You could literally stand on that lip, and so the door could be closed, the car could be moving, and in theory you could stand on that lip, so-called running board. And I think you usually had one on the left side and one on the right side of the car. So did this loop go in between? Was it wound parallel to those running boards, and then crossed the gap between the two underneath the car, John? Bob, is that about the way it was wired? W2OSR, K2LAW?
No, Dick. It ran in the same plane as the running board. So, it was a rectangular-shaped loop that fit directly underneath the running board. The running boards back then were maybe 8 inches wide, maybe even as much as 10 inches over.
So the square loop was under the car. Two of the legs of the square loop were parallel to the running board right under it. And two of the other legs went perpendicular to the running board from the left side of the car to the right side of the car, both in the front and the back, if it was a square loop. And now that's horizontally polarized square loop under the car, and two of the legs are directly under the running board, is my guess. Over to you, Bob, K2RAW.
Hey, Dick, maybe the best way to explain, just got the perfect example. You know what a paperclip looks like, right? It's long and thin, but it's a loop. Basically, that's the shape of the antenna that was mounted underneath the running board. It didn't go from one side of the car to the other. It just fit right underneath the running board.
Okay. Okay, John recognized. So, Bob, if I understand you correctly, this so-called loop antenna traversed the length of the running board at, say, for instance, the left side of the car, the driver's side. And so it's a rectangular loop, if I understand you correctly, almost the length of the running board, but the width of the antenna was about the width of the running board. Is that what you're saying? It was only on one side of the car. Is that what you're saying, Bob? Over to you.
As I remember, it said that's the way it was.
Okay, thank you. Unusual. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2
WGB. Yeah, I'm going to reveal my age, but before we had the complete hard top, they had a canvas patch that was in the middle of the roof. I remember those cars. And they also had that antenna that Bob is speaking about under that canvas patch. And it worked fairly well. And I believe that was in the late 30s. And then they went to full sheet metal roofs, and that disappeared.
So since that is so far before your time, John, my guess is it was your father or grandfather that's describing that to you. Is that approximately right, John?
Well, in my youth, that car was still running around. Quite a few people had them. A few of my neighbors had them, and that's where the antennas were. Kind of strange, but it was fairly common, and like I said, it worked well.
AC2IS, query?
I think it was AC2IS, and I think that's Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, let me know if you'd rather not address this question, but I had a question about, I think, just plain basic conductivity question, which I flubbed recently in regard to conductivity in regard to DC currents versus AC currents, AC2IS.
Okay, we've got you on the list, Bill, and it's a slightly different question than the antenna question we're addressing right now, by way of John, KC2SHO. I think, John, you said you had a real question. KC2SHO, K2LAW, the guy who asked the original question, you got it, John.
Yeah, I guess if we want to end the antenna thing there, I did find that interesting. Maybe if you can comment on an antenna that close to the ground in the lower bands, what's your opinion of how that would function?
If it was a bottom pole-like antenna, the whip antenna you have on a car, on an old-fashioned car, usually the whip antenna was insulated but stuck up from the fender of the car on many of the cars in the 50s, 60s, and 70s before they started putting the antenna in the windshield. There, that E-field sensing antenna, you want it to be as high as possible, bring it down lower to the ground, and it starts working rather poorly. In the case of an H-field antenna, a vertically polarized signal has an E-field that's vertical, an H-field, a magnetic field that's horizontal, and a horizontal plane piece of wire picks up that H-field antenna rather well, and the magnetic field of an AM broadcast antenna penetrates the ground a little bit. The fact that your antenna, your loop antenna, is close to the ground versus the altitude of, say, the roof of the car, that makes a rather small difference. So an H-field antenna behaves rather differently depending on how close it is to the ground. And the ground, as far as H-field is concerned, the ground is only partially conductive. So some of that, you could literally mount that horizontal polarized antenna, that loop antenna, in dry soil, maybe even a couple of inches below the surface, and it would still work. It takes a little bit of retuning to do that. Magnetic field is pretty nice in the way it can penetrate things, whereas E-field is not going to be as good at doing that. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. That would be an interesting experiment for somebody to do. Back to you for any final on this one, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment?
John?
Repeater, timeout.
John first, and then we'll pick up the comments. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, no real further comment on that. Definitely would like to find that set of photographs, wherever they're stored on my abyss of data here, and maybe see if there's some further explanation. Maybe I can find something online as well. It really fascinated me that it was so close to the frame underneath the car like that, how that worked out for them. Real good. Appreciate the answer, and looking forward to any other comments. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
W2OSR.
Bob recognized, but first we have the man that said comment. Who was comment? Give us your full call letters and name, and then proceed with your comment.
Roger, Dick. This is Kilo 1, Mike Juliet Mike. My name's Mike. I just Googled it. There's quite a bit online about running boards, antennas under running boards. I have one up on my screen here for a 1940 Chevrolet Master and Master Deluxe, and it looks like a kind of like an H configuration, an insulator, an insulated bracket on each end, and a couple of wires that run from the front of the running, from the front end of the car end of the running board to the back end of the car running board, with a piece across, and then there's a little instruction that says this wire goes to the radio. It's actually assembly instructions. Kilo 1, Mike Juliet, Mike, over to you, Dick.
Very fine, Mike. Mike, number 2. And good stuff. At Google, I'm amazed that there are a number of people out there who think that they will never use Google for fear that it is user-derived material. And the very first time a subject appears on Google, it hasn't yet been peer-reviewed. Yes, there could be some errors, but I find an extremely low rate of errors in Google. An awful lot of the Google material is very valuable to me. There are people out there who think they don't want to use it. They think that their teachers have told them, don't use Google. Don't use it as a reference when you're answering homework. From my point of view, those opinions are severe. But each person has its opinion, obvious by what happened last Tuesday night. My goodness, are their opinions. Wow. And lots of protesting going on since that voting took place. W2OSR, K2LIW, go ahead, Bob.
Okay, Dick, in a couple of minutes in your email inbox, you're going to get something from me that's got a photograph of what it looked like.
Okay, I thank you. So, the running board antenna. And it's kind of amazing. When you get down to super low frequencies, a H-field antenna, a loop antenna, is a lot easier to construct and work well. People who try to build a radio to listen to a very low frequency, you know, 100, 200, 300 kilohertz of carrier frequency, to do it with a loop of wire is a lot easier than doing it with a whip. So picking up the H-field of a low frequency antenna, in my opinion, is a lot easier. As long as you make that loop resonant at the operating frequency, it works extremely well. So, you worry about the loop itself being, 1/100th of a wavelength or 1/1000th of a wavelength of total loop circumference. And you worry about that and what does it take to resonate it. It's really just an inductor, happens to be a leaky inductor that's not shielded. Let me drop it. And as long as you put the right size capacitor, a high Q, usually air variable capacitor, across that loop to bring it into resonance, it'll work like a charm at those frequencies. And you can decide to do it with a multi-turn loop, therefore you need a smaller capacitor, or a single turn of a sturdy, of a fairly thick piece of wire. In either case, you'll get approximately the same amount of signal, which is kind of amazing. Yeah, you'll get a higher voltage out of, but you have to do an impedance match. In other words, to make the loop itself resonant is step number one. Now the way you tap into that loop, whether you do it with a gamma rod or another smaller loop inside that goes to the coax cable, there's various ways you can couple into that resonant loop. But once you do that, it can pick up a low frequency HF or LF, low frequency signal. They can do it very well. Anybody have any further comments on that one before we go over to Joe number 2? Give me a call that is right now. K2RIW the TechNet.
W2OSR.
Go ahead, Bob. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I know myself and a couple of the guys over at the NASCAR Amateur Radio Club have played around with small loop antennas. Actually, I have one that I built that I carry in the back of my car. I made it in such a way that I can pop it up. It's a loop, the outside diameter of which is about 8 feet. and it will work on just about anything from 40 up to 10 meters. So it's amazing what you can do with a small space. Back to you.
My guess is when you change which band you're listening to, you're changing the value of the capacitor across that loop. And how did you couple into that loop, Bob? Do you have an inner small loop going to the coax cable? Or is there a gamma rod? What's your coupling mechanism?
It's a loop coupling system.
And your inner loop is how much smaller than the outer loop? Wait for the beeps.
The diameter of my inner loop is about 8 inches.
Yeah, and the ratio of the outer diameter to the inner diameter and the placement of the inner diameter all affects the impedance match. And the inner diameter loop is probably on the opposite end of the big loop's coupling capacitor. If the tuning capacitor is at 12 o'clock, your inner loop is probably located at 6 o'clock on the big loop. Is that approximately right, Bob?
Yeah, pretty close. Except mine's 180 degrees out of what you described. The capacitor is at the bottom and my loop is up at the top.
Yeah, the reason for that is that when the loop is doing its resonant thing, the big outer loop, you got a high voltage at the end where the variable capacitor is located. You got a high current 180 degrees away on that loop. The high current gives you a strong local magnetic field. Your inner loop connected to your coax cable is coupled to that magnetic field. And so you get a very good match down there. If you made the mistake of locating the inner loop close to the air variable capacitor, you would be getting very poor coupling, and to get an impedance match up there would be very difficult without making the inner loop a whole lot larger. So that loop that you built, was it from your past experience you decided to build it? Were you following a recipe from, say, for instance, one of the ARL antenna books? Where did the design come from, the one that you built about Wait for the Beeps, K2RAW?
I did manage to find some information on the internet about small loop antennas. I looked at one of the other guys had done, and I kind of winged it based on, you know, some sketchy information, and I got something that worked.
And I get the impression from what you said, you've used that between 40 meters and 10 meters. And you used it for both transmitting and receiving. How many watts did you put into that when you were transmitting, Bob? W2OSR, K2RIW?
Okay, the small portable one is for about 5 watts. That one was made to be used with QRP. I have another one which is made with a... It's a bigger loop. It's an 8-foot. The aluminum bar I used for the loop was 10 feet long, and that's rolled into a circle, whatever that turns out to be. It's probably a little bit more than 3 inches, 3 feet across on the diameter. It's a 1-inch wide, 1/8 inch thick. A piece of aluminum stock. A little difficult to bend, but I managed. That one, because I put a capacitor in it, I could handle the voltage. I could run that at 100.
And Bob, when you're running these loop antennas, tell me how you oriented it. Was the plane of the loop parallel to the ground? That would be vertically polarized, as far as the E-field is concerned. Or did you make the plane of the loop perpendicular to the ground and you rotated it in order to use the directional characteristics? Tell me how you oriented your loop antenna. Over to you, Bob. Wait for the beeps.
And W2OSR. It's perpendicular to the ground, so that you can turn it and use the directional characteristic. It's very effective in terms of getting rid of noise, depending on where the station is you want to listen to.
Now, when you would rotate it in order to favor a particular signal direction, from your memory, Bob, did you pick up the strongest signal when the plane of the loop was parallel to the signal you're listening to, or when the plane of the loop was perpendicular to the signal you're listening to? Which way did you pick up the strongest signal? And my guess is, when you did pick up a strong signal, you could rotate your loop 180 degrees and pick up the signal again, is my guess. W2OSR, K2LAW.
Exactly, Dick. They are quite directional, but they're not omnidirectional, they're bidirectional. Think of a hula hoop that you're holding so it's vertical in terms of, the ground, and you can then turn that around, and you're going to find a point at which your signal strength will pick up on a particular station, and the station then is either 0 degrees from you or 180 degrees from you, according to the way you got the loop pointed.
Agree. So it's a vertical hula loop, and now when you rotate it to get the strongest response in that particular direction, was the signal in the direction that's in the plane of the loop, or was the signal perpendicular to the plane of the loop? Which direction gave you the strongest signal, if you happen to remember? Over to you, Bob, K2RIW.
As near as I can remember, it was in the plane of the loop.
That's what I expected. So, if the plane of the loop was northeast-southwest, and northeast favors London, so a signal coming from London would be strongest in that direction. Opposite of common sense. Common sense would lead you to believe you'd like the signal to hit the plane of the loop perpendicular, not in the plane of the loop, parallel to it, but a vertically polarized signal has a horizontal magnetic field. The horizontal magnetic field going through the whole of the loop, so to speak, gives you the greatest reception, and that's when the plane of the loop is aimed toward the signal. Opposite of common sense. But that's where it gets the greatest reception, most of the time. Okay, I think the next person, I'm not sure whether or not we covered Joe yet. KC2QYW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe. KC2QIW, Queen, Yankee Whiskey. Over to you, John, if you're available. K2LAW.
Yeah, Roger, Roger. Name here is Joe, J-O-E. Yeah, Roger. Quick question. On my HF radio, when I key up on the mic, the fast mode channel comes on, but it does not change the channels, thank God. So my question to you is there like a quick fix for that, or do you think I should call up Yankee? Back to you, Dick.
Joe, you did tell us it's an HF rig, and you told us Yaesu. Yaesu, what model number? And the condition that's making you question, you said it so fast, I don't quite understand what you're saying. So tell us the Yaesu model number, and are you saying the display skips through numbers when you first key the mic, and then it settles on the right number? I'm not quite sure what you're saying. KC2QIW. K2IW in the tech net.
say he got it right about 50-50%. I'm going to try to stay slower. Yeah, it's a Yaesu STDX 3008. And when I key up on the microphone, the stock microphone that came with the radio, fast mode will come on, like a channel fast mode. So when you turn the big dial, when you turn the big knob, it's like fast mode, channel mode, whatever. But so that's what's happening. Like when I key up on the mic, the fast mode channel will light up on the display on the Yaesu. And so like what I'm saying is, like when I key up on the mic, it just goes into channel fast mode. And but it's not, you know, it's not changing the channels unless I turn the knob, you know. So that's what I'm getting.
Okay, the big knob tunes the frequency. And on most rigs, you have a fast tuning mode and a slow tuning mode of the big knob. So I think you're saying that one of the displays on the screen tells you you're in the fast tuning mode when you key it with the push-to-talk on the microphone. And I guess you're saying even if you're in the slow tune mode, when you key the mic, the fast tune mode display comes on. And I think most rigs, when you key the mic, if you made the mistake of keying the mic, holding it keyed, and grab the big knob, most rigs will not move in frequency when the transmitter is enabled. When they were in the receive mode, yes, you can tune the frequency. In the transmit mode, most rigs won't let you tune. So whether it's in the fast mode or the slow mode while you're transmitting, almost doesn't matter. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, Joe. KC2QYW, drag your feet a little bit in case someone else wants to tell us their opinion on all of this. K2YW at TechNet. You got it, Joe, after a little delay.
W2NDG.
W2NDG. I should know you. Tell me your name and your comment. You got it, Mr. NDG.
Dick, it's Neil, W2NDG. We were chatting the other night. On the microphone for your rig, there's a button that toggles between fast and normal tuning modes. And it's possible that either you are inadvertently hitting that button when you key down, or if there's something not quite right with the mic, keying down may actually be activating that circuit, whatever that button is, if it's not working correctly. If you know somebody who has the same microphone, and frequently that microphone will be used across different Yaesu rigs, I think I have the same one, you may be able to swap mics and see if the same thing happens. If not, then you have a faulty connection to the mic. Just keep an eye on your fingers when you're keying down and see what they're doing. But that would be my suggestion. W2NDG, back to net.
Yeah, I'm using a Kenwood rig right now, and I've got a button on top of it, which is two buttons, up and down. So in theory, when I'm in the receive mode, I can press those buttons. I just tried pressing the button now while I'm transmitting, and nothing happens. In the receive mode, it will go up and down in frequency. So, good question, a good suggestion you just gave us, Neil. So back to you, Joe. Be a little bit careful that a finger somewhere is not touching one of the other zillions of buttons. Quite a few often, some of these microphones are so darn sensitive that a guy makes the mistake of pressing one of the touch tone buttons while transmitting, and you hear continuous tones in the background. So some of those mics are very sensitive on that. KC2QYW. As you find out more about this, Joe, come back and tell us what you find out. KC2QYW. K2RIW, you got a joke.
Yeah, Roger that. Yeah, thank you, Neil. What happened was, I went out and bought a Superstar Workman stock mic that's wired to the Yates 2 radio. I got it on eBay for it was a cheap price, and yeah, I hooked up that stock microphone, and when I key up and talk, the radio will just go to fast channel mode, because I always leave it on slow mode. Like I always leave the fast mode off, you know. But so what I did was I went through the menus on the radio, and I took the beep off, because you know, like any time when you touch buttons on the SHF radio, you always hear beep noise, whatever. So I lowered the volume on the beep noise, so I don't hear that beep every time when I keep on the microphone. But I guess in the future I'll try to pick up another M831B8, the original Yates 2 microphone, and try it again and see what happens. So yeah, I'll let you guys know. Thank you. And back to you, Dick.
Same mic I have, by the way. I think it comes with every Yaesu rig. I have an FT450D.
Did you buy your Yaesu rig used and it came without a microphone? That's why you had to supply another microphone yourself? Is that what's happening, Joe? Over to you, Joe.
No, negative. I actually bought another microphone to test it out. I bought the radio new. I bought it new. So I don't even think it's a year old yet. So back to the net.
Okay, you bought your Yaesu FTDX 3008. You bought it brand new. When you use the microphone that came with it, do you get a similar response? Back to you, Joe.
No, it would never used to do that. It would never used to go into that fast mode. I mean, channel, I think it's called like channel fast mode. Something like that, yeah, like channel fast mode. So when you turn the big dial, you don't have to put so much effort into it. The frequencies go really, really fast when you turn it, but I don't like that feature because it's too fast, you know. So I always leave that fast channel mode off the radio. Yeah, so.
Joe, what made you stop using the microphone that came with the radio? You've now used another microphone instead. Did your first microphone get damaged? Over to you, Joe.
No, I always used the stock microphone, and then I noticed a couple of weeks ago I had that problem. So the only reason why I bought a different microphone, I just wanted to see if the Yaesu microphone was causing the problem. That's what happened. You know, I thought maybe the stock microphone was making that fast mode come on, you know. So it does it on both microphones. So I'm not sure, you know. Maybe the stock microphone is not working properly either. So who knows? Yeah,
the fact that both microphones give you the same phenomena makes me guess that it might not be a microphone function. It could be something funny with the plug that the microphone goes into, where two of the pins are touching each other inside, and so that the push-to-talk function is also keying this fast-tune function. I'm guessing that it could be within the Yaesu itself, not with the microphones. But when you try a third microphone, if you get a hold of one, that'll give you a pretty strong clue. If the third microphone you get a hold of, which is known to be compatible with that 3008, and if that also does it, then there would be a strong piece of evidence to me that it's something about the wiring of the rig behind the front panel, not the mic itself. To get three mics in a row that are miswired, and two different brand names, so to speak, that would be a pretty rare case. That's a once in a blue moon type thing. You see what I'm saying on that one, Joe? So when you finally get to the bottom of this, come back and tell us what you find out. KC2QIW for any other comments. KQIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, roger that, roger that. Yeah, thank you very much, and I love you guys. And I guess I could do a quick comment. All the amateur radio guys